This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Ahmet C. Bozer, who is president of Coca-Cola International. Mr. Bozer, welcome to our interview, which we're conducting here at Coca-Cola headquarters in Atlanta.
Pleasure to have you here, and thank you for having me.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Istanbul, Turkey, and raised in Ankara, Turkey.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Yeah, it was the parents, it was the whole environment in Turkey in the, let's say, 70s from age 10 and forward. Which was an environment of a lot of can't-dos. So, for example, when I was 21, at the time I left Ankara to go to school here in the U.S., it was illegal to have $1 in your pocket because there was a law called the Law of Protecting the Turkish Lira. It was illegal to have foreign exchange, and it was quite controlled. And I think the world was a different place at that time, the 70s and 80s. We're not like now. It is much more global, it is much more focused on growth, and it is much more connected. So I actually came out of a fairly controlled and maybe closed to the world type environment, and to go to school here, only later to realize that the sort of the roots and the background that I have received in Turkey until that time that I left, combined with the culture here in the United States, actually created something that I thought was quite helpful for me.
And this culture that you describe in Turkey when the economy was unstable, really, did it help you develop an agility of dealing with uncertainty?
Yeah, I would probably talk about it in two phases. Until age 21, well, I was just a student. Probably the family obviously shapes you a lot, and at that time, even though I have not felt the sort of the achievement pressure as maybe you might think of today, that you have to always get the highest grades, that was not in our family. It was more to do with gaining basic habits of discipline, respect, etc. The other thing I think that really helped me a lot at that age was I played basketball from 10 years old until 21. I learned teamwork. We learned how to deal with wins and how to deal with losses, and how to be committed to each other as a team. And so the sportsmanship is, I think, has a lot of parallels with the business world in that sense. When I came back to Turkey in 1992, that I to work in Turkey. What you asked is to get the agility in an hyperinflationary environment was actually very important, because this is where you make daily decisions. The foreign exchange might move significantly every day. Interest rates might move significantly every day. And I was head of finance for some time. That certainly helped me with a lot of agility, flexibility. For my business.
So there are two issues here. One is your Turkish background. Turkey is a nation of traders. Does that play in the habits that you developed?
Well, interestingly, I was raised in Ankara, which is more of a government town. And what was valued most in Ankara was more professionalism, your knowledge, and your continued, let's call it, intellectual advancement. If I lived in Istanbul, it would be very different. Then trading and business success, that would weigh in more heavily. So in my case, it was more the other that sort of built into it. And maybe one of the learnings that I've had there is I've always tried to look at what I do as a professional what is my service? What is the best way to do that service? What is my impact? And sort of that drive for you know, better professionalism is probably what I might have gotten.
So in a way, it's a business professionalism with public service and a public perspective built on top of that.
Probably.
Yeah. What was the impact of your formal education?
I'll probably share a little. The Turkish word for business is called işletme. And that word also means many other things. So if I'm sort of pulling your leg on something, it's also to call işletme. And if you were living in an apartment and you are the apartment manager, you're called işletmeci. So when I got into the business school in 1981, pretty much everybody around us says, "What are you going to işletme? You know, what is this about? What is this? Is this a profession?" As a 18-year-old, that doesn't make you feel too good. That really drove me to learn a lot about what business was all about, but at least on the books. And people's cynicism about the subject matter actually pushed me to get really deep into learning about what it's all about. I remember in college I was trying to construct holistic models of what this is all about and what's important.
I like to ask my guests what they see as the skills and temperament required for the work they do. So first let's talk about skills. What is the skill set you see as really important for an aspiring business person, entrepreneur?
Yeah, I'd caveat what I'm going to say with a few things because everything is so situational. I guess one skill that's very important is that you're very context sensitive, which means you understand where your organization is coming from and going to, what are its challenges. So, you know, if you're working in an organization that is working in emerging markets to build a business, leadership to lead a business like that would require different skills than being in a more mature country that has to deal a lot more with innovating all the time. That might require different skills. So I guess I would say if there's one thing common, that is really to be able to read the context and sort of step back from it and really understand what sort of leadership skill that requires. I guess the second thing is to realize that this is not done by one person. You know, you may be the top person in the organization, But none of us will have all the skills necessary for the mission, for the job that the company requires. So it then comes to, you know, are we able to put together a leadership team that sort of complements each other, that can collectively address this, all the needs. So being able to lead a team of professionals, which if you sort of dig deeper into that, requires other skills.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it sounds like listening is very important, that listening to your own people, but also listening to the people in the environment where you're trying to do business.
Yes, listening is very important, and I think also being very comfortable with the fact that you really don't know everything, you don't have all the answers, you don't necessarily have all the skills that is required, but the key skill is if you sort of think of it as a system, that in your company you have yourself, your team, and a whole bunch of stakeholders that affect it. I guess the systems thinking is a very important skill, that you're able to see that system, you're able to see where it might need interventions, where it might need further encouragement, where it might need changes. So being able to preside over a system with that kind of a perspective, I think, is also an important skill.
In business, risk is important, taking chances on the one hand, but on the other hand, once you have an ongoing operation, you have to have caution involved also. So being careful about where you take risks.
Yeah, and I would maybe reposition that a little bit. It's really about choices. So, calculated risks are good risks. Uncalculated risks that you don't have mitigation plans, or not. It's a bit like, you know, we play backgammon. You know, sometimes, you know, you take risks in backgammon all the time. But you always have a fallback.
Where does imagination and creativity come in?
You know, that comes in, I think, when you're really pressured. So when things are going okay, those are the more dangerous times. When things are going well, this is, I worry most of the time, if you have multiple years, everything seems to be going well. Well, in those multiple years, probably some things are building up to get you in the following years. But when you are faced with a lot of adversity, provided that you have a strong will to overcome those and to see those adversities as something that is actually there to open a new window for you or to open a new future for your company, and you actually have the will to actually use it that way, that's when I think the creativity comes. Now, and again, that is not something that a leader should rely on, is just his own creativity. The leader should, you know, behave in ways that nurtures an environment where the creativity and the free flow of ideas can flourish. So that's how it comes into play, I think.
What about temperament? Are there universals here with regard to business?
You know, I think I would say as a leader, we have to be accepting of all kinds of different temperaments, because, you know, sometimes we make the mistake of just trying to expect everybody to be perfect while we're not. So I guess point one I would make is that we have to honor the diversity, and we're all human beings. We all have different thresholds of patience or reacting to things, and that is okay, as long as there is commitment, there is good intention, that we're all part of the same team. So we can't be so hard on that. But I think what I would also say is that if one can find a way to be comfortable within adversity, comfortable psychologically, not comfortable sort of accepting results, sort of comfortable psychologically, but always keep pushing for it. I mean, that temperament, if we can sustain that kind of temperament all our lives, that's perfect. That's great. So that is very important, because people look at their leaders. I mean, I remember days that, you know, sometimes I go to the cafeteria and somebody would make a comment, well, your face, you look a little bit concerned today. Is there a problem? Because if the leader is concerned, everybody's concerned. So if the leader's temperament is you know, more radical in many ways, that's going to reflect on the organization. So it is a responsibility, actually, of the leader to make sure that the overall psyche of the organization is what it needs to be, which is positive, which is aspiring going forward, and yet realistic. Yes, we will go through hard times, we'll go through difficult times, and it's okay to, I think, to show those feelings of concern in an authentic way. But then there's a line when there are signs that the leader might have lost hope or has become cynical or has become a pessimist or something. That's the line. You know, you cannot cross that line, because then you're doing harm to your organization.
What has your learning process been like? Do these insights come from your background, from your education, or the actual experience of doing the work?
Somehow I was very interested in self-development. And I sort of knew that, you know, you will never get to an ideal state, but you could always constantly improve yourself. And that's not just by reading things. That's really by learning something, learning what you want to learn, and actually doing something with what you learn, which means reflect that into your behaviors. And you will do that with mistakes all along. So it was more for me like a continuous improvement journey for self-development. And I kept that. For the last 30 years, I've been And every time I would read something there, I would always look for, okay, this sounds right, what they're saying is. I wonder what is the root of this. So I don't want to have to remember a million things. I want to get to the root of everything as much as we can and learn 7 or 8 things, but then live them. So I've had that self-drive to do that, because maybe that was connected to the fact that, you know, I got to learn my profession, and one of the things in that profession is those kinds of sort of soft skills, if you will. You see this over and over again. The functional knowledge is there. Schools are great. People learn wonderful skills from a functional standpoint, whether it's in finance or marketing or operations. What really makes a difference, I think, is the leadership skills, soft skills, whatever you'd like to call them, because those are not taught. I think they could be, but they're not taught. And so this is where I felt this is where I could sort of continuously develop myself. And I think that development is open to everyone, because none of us know our own potential. You know, it's just we could change, we could learn if we have the willingness to do that. So, but we have to work at it, and we have to be open about it. You know, we have to be open to feedback. We have to be open to criticism, and learn from that.
Coke is an interesting company, and you, as president of the international division, in the sense that diversity is built in. So there is a global headquarters, and there are branches all over the world. Your portfolio has hundreds of countries within it. So the question, talk a little about that, because you were head of the Turkish operation. You obviously at the global headquarters now, because it really is an important way at looking at the world, understanding at the world, being able to think and act globally, but also to think and act locally.
Yes, and that's the, I guess, gift of Coca-Cola Company to all its associates, in a way that over time, I think we have built this global enterprise that is based on great local relationships, but also a robust global organization. So we have partners in 200-plus countries, most of which are locals from those countries, who really understand the culture, who understand the markets, who understand the business. But then when you connect that with our organization's ability to form relationships on the ground to work with them, with clear role sorts. So Coca-Cola Company is responsible for the marketing of our brands, for example, whereas though our partners are responsible for producing and selling and distributing, they got to work together. So there's a great reason for us to work together, because if we don't work together, the job doesn't get done. But then we have to have the ability to be able to form these relationships in 200-plus countries to be successful. Now, you got to throw a huge dose of empowerment and collaboration into this whole system globally, because it is so big that we have to actually leverage the strength of our local people, not just trust them. You know, it is expected that, you know, they are such an important part of this equation for it to work. But then you can't be almost like 200 independent countries, because we're a global organization. So there has to be a lot of collaboration across, and that can be enabled by the center here, or it could actually happen in a networked way.
When you entered or chose the path of business, what you needed to do to run an organization was probably very different, much more command and control. How do we make money? How has that changed?
I would have to say something about the question, though, because it was a very funny way in which I ended up in business. I didn't really choose it, I would tell you that, because how you got into college in Turkey in 1977 was that there were, I think, maybe a million students applying for college and really 50,000 or so slots to get into college. And I was fortunate enough that I was raised in a bigger city and all of that. And I had, you made your preferences. And my first preference was medicine of one university. Second preference was medicine. Third was industrial engineering. Fourth was medicine. And fifth was business. I got the business because that's the score I made. And I had no idea what business was all about. So I didn't go into it with any with knowing anything. As I learned it and as I started working in it, I guess I was very fortunate in some sense that I started my career in the United States, because that's where the business world is so much more advanced, especially at that time compared to the rest of the world, that I didn't even have to make a leap from command and control to more leadership type, because I lived in it. I lived in it. I experienced it. I had great bosses. I had. I was able to experience it all.
But over time, has collaboration, taking account of the environment you've become more important for Coke, for you, as globalization has increased?
It is. I would say, we are a brand company, but we're also the ultimate relationship company. We cannot do anything on our own. We have to collaborate with our bottlers. We have to collaborate with our customers. At the end of the day, our results will be better if our customers see us as an important part of their growth. If our bottlers see us as a valuable partner and we see our bottlers as a valuable partner. So it is really all about running these relationships. That is an essential part of our job. You just have to do it to get the job done. And therefore, it becomes a very important cultural element.
But it becomes, society has changed. There's so many issues that are on the table in the societies you're dealing with that suggests that your agenda increases manifold.
And then I think it places our company in a great position, because if you look at the key, social issues in a given country, it's becoming clear that not one institution can solve it. Governments can't solve it. Businesses can't solve it. NGOs can solve it. But I think if they got together, they can solve it. And this is what we're experiencing in many initiatives around the world with what we call the Golden Triangle, that if these institutions around the world can effectively come together, combine their strengths, and go after a common objective, then they can make a difference. But on their own, they can't. So you're absolutely right. That is becoming so much more important. If you then move from there to the consumer's expectations from the companies, consumers do expect us to do this. They do expect us to make the world a little better, make their world a little better place. So, and we can't do it on our own. We have to do it working in our golden triangles.
Is there a problem as more and more stakeholders are involved, the portrait of the problem has to expand, basically. So then you're back to what you were talking about before within the organization, that is structural issues that take account of the interests of all of the stakeholders. You've written on water. That is one priority that Coke has identified. Talk a little about that, because if you're going to solve the water problem, there's a multivariant solution, as you say in your paper.
Absolutely. You look around the world, and there are so many different problems related to water. In some parts of the world, it could be just access to clean water. In some parts of the world, it is the underground reserves becoming less and less. In some countries, it may be that industrialization has created, sort of distorted the nature in a way that some things you have to be restored for. So, and that is such a critical resource for us as well as the communities. We basically identified that as one of the key areas of our sustainability agenda because it is very important to our business and it is very important to the communities. Now, to look at each of these different problems, we cannot do that on our own. So in Central Asia, we were doing a project to help provide access to clean water. Well, and I may be remembering this incorrectly, but it may have to do with the pipes, or it may have to do with other things. Now, in these projects, there's always things that we can do. So we have partnerships around the world. We have expertise from our own manufacturing operations that we can contribute to these projects. And then we're going to have to partner with the governments there to be able to make that. We have hundreds of sort of community water projects such as those that are all in some way a Golden Triangle project. We have the Replenish Africa initiative to bring by next year, and I think we're already ahead of that, clean water to 2 million people. Again, in each country, that's a different kind of partnership that we're involved in.
In the paper that you co-authored, I found this line, which I thought was interesting. You're talking about water as a structural problem, and you say, with strong political will, sustained pressure from an informed public, and a can-do attitude from water professionals and institutions pursuing intersectoral cooperation, the world's water management problem can be addressed effectively. So that's really a complex set of processes that have to be put in place.
Absolutely, and I 100% believe in that. The water issue is a stewardship issue. Mm-hmm. It's not, in my view, it's not like we're going to run out. It is how we steward it. And that requires mega collaboration, and all of those elements that you've read would be required. But this is what's required from us as businesses now. We have to step up our game in becoming better collaborators, better partners who can bring their strengths into the project and who can align behind common objectives and who work towards them. So it sounds difficult. But we have so many of these examples that we're doing in different countries that encourages us.
And it's as you just said, it's not something you can do alone. So you must have to engage in an education process where you're helping people understand the problem on the one hand, but you're also learning.
Absolutely. And again, even those we might be bringing some expert partners that we work with in some capacity in some part of the world to a specific problem. As I was saying, we are the ultimate networking and relationship company.
So what is a Coke problem in producing its brand has required you to develop expertise that may be useful in this different context?
I guess we could say that. Yes. So I believe this is an area that is a natural sustainability topic for Coca-Cola because it has some expertise in it. It has uses of the resource. It has a reach of 200-plus countries around the world, which in itself is an asset. It has a rich portfolio of partners. So it becomes a natural area for us to get involved in.
What about empowerment of women, which I think also is a goal that you've identified?
Obviously, I don't think I need to say more about the criticality of women's economic empowerment to the world's economic growth as well as social improvements. So I won't say much about that. But if you look at our system in Africa, we have so many women retailers in our value chain. And as you start looking at their businesses, they're a business owner, they're a mother, they're a wife, And they're just trying to do so much. And they do need support. They do need support and they do need help. Sometimes they may need support in starting a business. Sometimes they may need support in networking with each other. Sometimes they just need support in how to keep track of their finances. And some of the things that might appear too simple to you and I might not have been working for them in their businesses. And by actually helping them, what we're helping is, A, we're helping our business because as they become better retailers, they become better partners to us, but they're also becoming better in their communities.
A third part of your agenda, as I've read about the company, is well-being. That is the well-being of the people and the societies that you're operating, and obviously the consumers. That's a complicated issue, isn't it? Well-being.
It absolutely, and I think the. Us human beings, we also complicate things more than we should. At the end of the day, I'm sure I'm oversimplifying it. I try to use it for my own life, but everything is about balance. If you're balanced in what you consume and how you expand that, even within what you consume, you know, I was taught, if you're going to get proteins, get it from multiple sources, not just one source. So it's variety and balance, and just sort of keep the middle road. You know, don't exaggerate either way. Psychologically, physically, all of that. At the end of the day, just live a life like that, and obviously follow the right disciplines of, you know, exercise, etc. I think well-being issue, you know, would be mostly resolved.
If you look at well-being as a multivariant problem in the way water is, that suggests that you're going to really have to be involved in the politics of these issues and the new definitions of an agenda. I mean, I'm thinking here about well-being involving exercise, people being concerned about, you know, obesity, and so on. Talk a little. I mean, what I'm interested in is not Koch's answer, but rather how you begin to think about the problem, not just you, but all sectors of society.
I'm not so sure that, you know, we have to get right into the politics of it. The question is, can we motivate people at a young enough age to be more active? Can we create the opportunities for them to be more active? So, for example, in Germany, you know, we had a campaign with Fanta, which is called Play. Well, by actually working with the municipality there to make those playgrounds a little better, so that more attractive, so that people can go, well, you start moving, you know, maybe 20,000 more kids. I'm just making up the number. So, and we are all around the world. So we can just focus on that, for example, in terms of inspiring people to be more active. Obviously, that's one part of how we think about it. We also have, from our own products standpoint, are we offering sufficient choices to people? Are we transparent with what our products include? We do not market to children under 12. So basically make sure, you know, you look at yourself as a company and that, you know, you are offering the right choices, but at the same time be helpful in the community by, encouraging people to be more active. And when we connect with governments around the world on these topics and with NGOs, that attracts a lot of attention, and people do want to partner with us on things like that. We have, in schools, we have Let's Get Out and Play. In some countries, you know, just children are just studying and sitting and working under a lot of pressure. Well, I mean, if you could just get out half hour a day, and if you just do little exercises and run around every day, that makes a difference. It actually makes their classes different. So any health ministry approaches that with a very positive attitude.
And you can make basketball as part of your program. One final question here. If students were to watch this interview and they're thinking about preparing themselves for a future in business, what lessons might they learn from your career, and what advice would you give them about preparing for that future?
Well, obviously to have a start with a very long-term mindset. Meaning, you know, try to picture sort of not what you're going to do, but how you want to be as a business professional. You know, maybe they, you know, some of them will get into higher leadership positions and maybe not, and that's all okay. So start with that vision. Commit to their own development. And that starts with their first job. And I would say they should be very disciplined about sort of processing their learnings and accumulating their learnings. And while they're doing that, not to stay too narrowly focused on the specific job that they may be doing. Always look for, you know, what's the next business process I may be impacting, and how does my work affect that? And just keep expanding their horizons. And so, you know, this is all I would say, you know, picking your own development as the ultimate goal and seeing every job, every assignment, not just to get it done, but also to really learn and keep building skills. Over time, I think they will probably get to a point that they could be more purposeful about what they want to learn. And that depends on what they want to do. One of the mistakes most of us make is that we have very rigid plans. Well, in 5 years' time, I want to be in this position. And so much stress is put on that without really understanding what that means, what do I need to do to get there. We put so much stress, and then we frustrate ourselves. But if you had a goal of goal where you have opened to yourself many possibilities. So when I was in finance, in all my career conversations, I'd always said, I'm open to a career in finance. I'm also open to a career in general management. In fact, I prefer. There's always preferences, but there's always options because you never know which path will get you where. It's a bit of a chaotic environment, the business environment, the organizations. You know, your next assignment depends on many factors that are not in your control. So what is in your control is to have a flexible plan and then keep developing yourself against that plan and not necessarily put unrealistic or uninformed, rigid targets for yourself. But the best target you could put for yourself is that, you know, you would excel in developing yourself. Now, if I were to open that up a little bit, I would look at a couple of dimensions of that. One is, you develop yourself for what? You're developing yourself to add value where you are, so that if you're adding value of one today, you can add value of two today. So what is the value that you would add? What is the contribution that you're making to your organization? So your development has to be aimed at that. The second one is the relationships. It is so important that you start building the relationships, positive relationships. So sometimes if you're just guided by a very short career objective, you could actually hurt those relationships. And you've done the biggest damage to yourself. Well, what is a good relationship that you build inside or outside the organization? And I always tell people two things. You know, make sure that the person thinks about you in two areas. One, you're really competent in what you do, or you're at least, you know, you're getting there, and that you could be trusted. That's very important. And that you connect with people at a human level, at all dimensions. The other mistake we make is, you know, we treat people as machines at work. You know, you got to do it. No, they're all whole human beings. So so that kind of relationships, just focusing on building the right relationships, those relationships, you don't have to get something or give something tit for tat. You're really just investing in a relationship. And now, so those are the things, you know, focusing on your value, focusing on your relationships and developing yourself would be maybe the main pillars that I would just keep in my mind.
Well, on that note, Mr. Roser, I want to thank you for taking the time from your busy schedule to be with us. This was very informative and enlightening. Thank you very much. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.